From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the late 19th century, Lulu Hurst transfixed audiences as the Georgia Wonder. An electrical storm supposedly gave the teenager supernatural powers to catapult grown men across stages on chairs. She performed on stages from Cedartown, Georgia, to the East Coast and Midwest. Lulu appeared in front of members of Congress and government scientists. She was tested by Alexander Graham Bell, the faculty at Mercer University and the Medical College of Georgia, all baffled by the mysterious force of the electric maid. Then, after 2 years of captivating audiences, she quit and later wrote a book saying it was all deflection and physics. Atlanta-based author Jessica Handler's new novel, The Magnetic Girl, gives Lulu's run a fictional turn in a story that illustrates America's historic attraction to cons, bamboozlers, and magical thinking. And Jessica Handler, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Virginia.
Congratulations, too.
Thank you.
So she was a real person, born Lulu Hurst, she was called Lulu, however, in Polk County, Georgia in 1869. When did you first learn about her?
I love that you know that her birth name was Lula.
In NPR here.
Yes, exactly. That's what the census has her as, is L-U-L-A. I first met Lulu Hurst about a decade ago. My mother and I were fascinated by the idea of stories of women and girls who were known or believed to be exceptional, physically, culturally, intellectually. And randomly, just out of the blue, my mother emailed me a digital clipping from a magazine called Cassiers that was called The Feats of the Magnetic Girl Explained. And I just fell in love with Lulu. And my mother sent it to me sort of as a wow, check this out kind of thing. And I just fell in love with her.
Well, you wrote her in the first-person voice of this very aware but awkward 14-year-old Georgia girl who, some beautiful lines in here, she wanted to be elsewhere. She had a wanderlust, but she was bound by her family's diminished circumstances, certainly, and by her younger brother, Leo. How did you, who is also fictional, right?
Yes.
How did you create this inner life for this girl?
There are many versions of the book. I worked on this book for a number of years and tried it different ways. And the first-person point of view worked for me very much because I was a teenage girl. You were a teenage girl. And teenagers, regardless of gender, I think if they are smart and sensitive people, it's very hard to figure out what the world is doing to you and how you feel. So the place you go is inside, inside your mind, inside your heart, inside your fears. That's where you live.
And inside of her mind, she had powers to captivate.
She did. She did.
She stopped a wild fox in its tracks, she thinks, by looking straight into its eyes.
Yeah.
And she was abetted by a book, The Truth of Mesmeric Influence by Mrs. Henrietta Wolfe, which you made up.
Yeah.
So who were the mesmerists? What did they do?
Mesmerism is an idea that had its beginnings, I think, in the 1700s. There was a scientist named Anton Mesmer, who was a German physician who pretty much started the idea, and he called it animal magnetism, because we are animals, and we are magnetically attracted to one another emotionally in various ways. So this kind of predates hypnotism as we know it. The idea behind animal magnetism loosely is that we all have fluids in our bodies, which we do, that balance our health and well-being. And it's magnetic force, magnetic fields that pulls them in this direction or that direction. So if they are disrupted in some way, perhaps you are ill, perhaps you are off balance. So he created a variety of treatments that ostensibly helped people.
And this is something that her father picked up on. You know, he schools Lula in stage presence and distraction, basically the art of the con.
Yeah.
And tells audiences that she gained her freakish power in an electrical storm.
Yeah.
Now, this is at a time when electricity was new and frightening. You know, people thought, what's going to happen with this dangerous stuff to our bodies? So why is this time of growing science so richly populated also with supernatural belief?
Supernatural. Mesmerism eventually in the 19th century kind of mixed up with electricity. Because if you think about electricity, you can't see it. So what is it? And if electricity in practice was new, so in rural America in the mid to late 19th century and really into the 20s, 30s, 40s in the 20th century, people didn't always have electricity. Certainly the big cities started to have it. But what is it? Is it fire? Is it in your body? Is it spirits? People didn't know. So the idea is that Lulu put a pin in and out of a mattress by her cousin's ear during a lightning storm. And now whenever there's a lightning storm, I sort of look at it and go, I wonder if I could do that. And she timed it to where the popping of the pin worked with the popping of the lightning. And her cousin, and I want to stress that in her autobiography, she does dedicate that book to her beloved family. But her cousin kind of said, oh, you've got the power of electricity in your fingers. And my sense is that Lulu went, okay, sure. So, yeah.
Well, that's part of the thing, you know, the mind of a 14-year-old girl. You want to be magic, right? You want to change your circumstances, especially if you're growing up in a little town and you want it to be different. So there's this kind of belief in her. Well, that's what's interesting about the book. You never quite tell us if her powers are real or just in her head.
Yeah. I think that the way I have her in the story is she's not entirely sure. Mm. And without giving away the story, I think that she comes to some kind of understanding about it, or at least a place to put this idea in her head. But she's not entirely sure of it. I think in real life, she was the kid who could win a staring contest. I also, research indicates that she was tall. She was a big kid. And there's an element of fear or discomfort, certainly in that era, about a woman who maybe had physical power, physical strength, didn't look demure.
My guest is Jessica Handler. She's a professor at Oglethorpe University. She's written two memoirs. Her first novel, The Magnetic Girl, was named in the Wall Street Journal's list of the 10 books you'll want to read this spring. So we are talking about it now. I'm going to try in detail or just to sort of summarize her act on stage. She would hold a cane and have men pressing down on it. And suddenly, you know, she would easily flip it upward and men would tumble, or she'd sit them on a chair and be able to sort of flip them over. And of course, the newspaper said she was levitating people. Right. She was lifting tables with 25 children on it.
Yeah.
So there's this whole kind of tension between fact and fiction. But it's wonderful because she goes on the road. You know, she's discovered. She's on stage in Cedartown. And then she's off to Rome, Georgia, and Atlanta, and then up the East Coast. It's wonderful, the life on the road. Here are some of the acts that you write about. The Jolly Pathfinders, Professor Buncher and his marionettes, Schwartz and Mendel, the Hebrew comedians. Did you just make these all up into any of these actual acts from the time?
Some of them were actual acts, and I don't know necessarily that she performed with those acts. I think Professor Buncher was a real act. I went through a lot of vaudeville programs, and I just love the names. And I know that there were various acts like Schwartz and Mendel. There were certainly people who did monologues of Shakespeare, did monologues from theatrical performances of the era. There were also singers. There were certainly animal acts. It was just fabulous. I wish I could have seen it.
I know. It's amazing. Yeah. But I wonder how audiences would be captivated by a girl wrestling with a cane now. But there is this kind of thing, this growing tension between science and humbuggery, as her father calls it, magic. Spiritualists and mediums. There was a big boom after the Civil War. And her father says, folks are ready for the humbug. You know, they believe anything wrapped up in a bow. They won't admit it because they don't want to feel like they fell for something. And I couldn't help reading this thinking of, you remember when the Russian troll, the bot farm was indicted? Mm-hmm. The people said, like, it is so easy to convince the American public of anything. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's, when you're looking at this, is this part of the American character, this wanting to believe in something that's just magic?
I think it's part of the human character, certainly the character in any society that is moving so fast that we feel that we don't have control over what we know or what we knew yesterday or 2 weeks ago or this afternoon. I wasn't thinking about the Russian bot farm when I wrote this. And other people have asked me, was I thinking about the Me Too movement, things like that. But I'm very interested in why we believe what we believe. And I don't want to discount anybody's particular belief. But I know that in conversation, sometimes people will say things. And let's go to song lyrics, for example, which is, you know, somebody will say, oh, the lyrics to that song are such and such. And you go, no, they're not. Why do you think that? So I'm very interested in why people have such fealty to beliefs until they don't. What brought them there? Why did they change? Mm. Right? And this could have to do with health. It could have to do with faith. It could have to do with culture. It could have to do with something as simple as I can't eat that food because it's bad.
Right.
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 Yeah.
Not always rational.
Not always rational.
But she's out there performing for audiences. She knows it's a bit of a con, but there is as we said, there's a part of her that doesn't know if it's true or not. And there is this, I don't know, a crippling self-doubt. You know, mm-hmm. every time she goes out there, there's always this flicker of wonder about whether she's going to be able to actually deliver on what she's supposed to do. And, you know, you're a creative, you're a writer, you teach writing to people. Is that flicker of doubt, is that another human thing? Or is this part of the whole art of performance?
Isn't that called imposter syndrome?
I think it is.
Yeah, imposter syndrome. And sometimes I think everybody has it, particularly, well, I can't speak for everybody, but we were talking about this earlier. It's an element of imposter syndrome. Can I do this time? And the other element is the idea of learning to perform. And I don't mean perform theatrically, but when you're a teenager, you're learning to perform as the adult you think you're going to be or the adult the world wants you to be. Which adult am I going to be and how do I do that? And in a case like Lulu Hearst's, both in the novel and I think in real life, there were expectations on her. She earned a lot of money once she got going. Mm-hmm. And supported her family. So, of course she wanted to do that. And of course she wanted to be helpful. And that came from performance, which has an element of falsehood. So right away, there's an internal conflict with that.
Mm.
Who am I going to be? And I'm speaking as Lulu. Who is Lulu going to be when she grows up? And what does that mean to her? And how did she make that person?
And she did grow up. Why do you think she quit? I mean, her biography, I read a little bit of it mm-hmm. yesterday. It's just sort of a puff piece. Do you have any ideas?
I don't really know why she quit. I mean, she does talk about the fact that she, in the autobiography, she talks about the fact or writes about the fact that it was time to quit and the people were perceiving her in a way that wasn't true to her, mm-hmm. which I think that emotional truth holds up in my novel as well.
Mm-hmm.
But she never comes out in real life and says, I quit for this reason, and here's the reason. She does in the autobiography, in the second half of it, write about how gullibility allowed her this fame, which then makes it the audience's responsibility. In the novel, I was very curious because her autobiography doesn't come out and say, I quit for this reason. So I wanted to find out, I wanted to explore, why would she have done it? What were the stakes for her emotionally, for her family? So I created some issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, it's a novel. It's got to have some tension, got to have issues.
Yeah.
So you've been living with Lulu Hearst in your head for a long time,
yeah.
the magnetic girl. It's
yeah.
going to be tough to let go of her? What's this like?
I love her so much. And I just, when I was writing this, I had a picture from Frank Leslie's Illustrated from, I think, 1884 in my office that I bought on eBay looking at me. And I've taken it down. But I haven't gotten rid of it. It's just in a different place in my office. I think she'll always be with me in a good way.
Well, she could win that staring contest. She's going to get a hold on you for
yeah.
a long, long time. Jessica Handler, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Handler, she's professor of writing at Oglethorpe University. And her first novel, The Magnetic Girl, is out. Named in the Wall Street Journal's list of 10 books you'll want to read this spring. So take heed. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The CDC expects the number of people over the age of 65 to double by 2030. Meanwhile, the Alzheimer's Association projects the disease will increase by nearly 27% in Georgia by 2025. But the number of people trained to care for those with cognitive and physical degeneration is not keeping up. The Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving is working to fill that gap. Gail Alston is director of its training center, and she joins us on the line from Americus, Georgia, where the organization is based. Gail, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Morgan Rowe, she's a Decatur resident whose father has dementia. She took care of him at home for years. He's now in assisted living. Morgan, thank you for being here.
Hi, thank you so much.
So, Gail, I'm curious about why former First Lady Rosalind Carter made caregiving an issue to focus on. Was this a personal experience for her?
Yes, it was very personal, as a matter of fact. Her father had leukemia and actually passed away when Mrs. Carter was only 13 years old. Mm. Then a year later, her grandmother passed away and her grandfather moved in with them. So she not only witnessed caregiving, but she was also very much involved in the caring for family members who had chronic illnesses or frailty due to being older. Then when the Georgia Southwestern came to her, they said, we'd like to have an institute to honor you. She said, we need to be doing something for family caregivers, because she remembered how it affected her family. And that was back in 1987.
Right.
So
that was
very
then.
Early.
Right. And look at now. We heard about the numbers of people aging in the coming decades without members of caregivers increasing. So, Gail, will elder care likely fall to family?
Well, you know, elder care is already falling to families. Most care is done in the home by unpaid care workers, caregivers such as family or friends. In 2013, $470 billion worth of unpaid care was given. So we're already shouldering most of the care as family caregivers. Mm. Now, the real issue, of course, is going to be as families dwindle, what's going to happen next.
Right. And what if there is no family? What if there are no children to care or siblings to care for somebody?
Exactly.
Well, Morgan, you are here as somebody who, you know, took care of your dad at home. When did you first realize he needed more attention? What did that mean for you and your family?
Well, you know, I first started noticing things in probably 2013, but, you know, looking back, I can probably say it was probably a couple of years before that, that things were slipping from dad. And, I'd lost my mom in 2002, lost my brother then in 2014. So kind of everything was left to me. But I started noticing it really in 2013 and then started to take kind of steps to help him. And he lived in North Carolina. I lived in Georgia. He was adamant about not moving, abrasive about it, you know. As you can imagine, a man who's lived alone for a lot of years.
Yeah, exactly. And this hits close to home for me. As I told you earlier, my mom also has Alzheimer's. My sister is taking care of her with some in-home care. So what led you to the decision to move him in with you? This was back in 2016.
Well, I really started seeing things really getting bad. He'd had a couple of accidents. You know, bills were getting were a problem. He couldn't pay his bills right. There were a lot of things that I just wasn't able to do from afar as easily. I was traveling every other weekend to go visit my dad to take care of these things. And sometimes during the week, just because some things needed to be taken care of during the week. Mm-hmm. I knew that he needed to be in a safe place. I was finding food on the stove that had been burnt, you know, things like this when I would come over there. So I knew things were going in that direction.
Had you considered assisted living or memory care facilities?
I did, you know, and I did a lot of searching here in Decatur and the surrounding area. I went to a lot of different places and looking, and you know, I found Arbor Terrace in Decatur, which is where he's at, and I fell in love with them. It felt like home, and they have been amazing with them. Now, to that extent, you know, there's a certain, I mean, this is a memory care facility. They do have, you know, special care for that. But a lot of that responsibility, I feel responsible for my father, mm-hmm. you know, and so.
You mean despite the fact that he's being
exactly,
cared for by other people?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and the care there is not like a nursing home, you know, it's not like that, you know, it's more of a, they come in and they check on them. And, you know, there's a definitely someone there that helps with there's a nurse on duty there and everything. So
Gail, we're hearing about sort of two tracks, home care or facilities. Who is most likely to end up without the help they need when age or disease curbs their independence? Is it just about people who don't have children to care for them, or is it more about what a person can afford?
Well, it certainly is both of those things. You know, there's a phenomenon going on now of elder orphans, which are the growing number of people such as me who never got married and never had children. And as my mother used to say, as I was caring for her, you don't have a Gail. Who's going to take care of you? Mm. So now I have to be planning for, you know, as I get older, for that as best I can to figure it out. But also there's the idea that the workforce has to grow. And we're going to have to find ways to make that direct care working a more appealing profession, honor them for the value that they are, and also give them the training they need, both the family caregiver and the direct care workers need so much more training than they're getting. The family caregivers are going to need the information about the disease that they're dealing with, and then they need training in problem solving and stress management. You know, stress is a terrible hazard for family caregivers. It takes a toll because they forget, they set aside anything they've ever done in their previous lives that would address stress, because they're putting all their attention towards what their loved one needs.
Well, so Morgan need is sitting here. She is shaking her, nodding her head, rather, in agreement. What is Absolutely. Was it like trying to take care of your dad at home?
You know, I can tell you that I didn't sleep a lot because he had sundowners, and
sundowners. I'm sure not
sundowners. Elder patients with dementia or Alzheimer's tend to. You know, when the sun goes down, they start walking around. And
they become more alert at that point.
Yeah, and he was opening doors, and, you know, I just wasn't able to sleep. You know, if it wasn't for my neighbors and friends, you know, I couldn't go to the grocery store, you know, or I couldn't go to the gym. Mm-hmm. I couldn't go do things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that I wanted to keep my dad at home. I would love to have kept my dad at home. And perhaps if I had had someone, you know, in my life with me that wanted to do that, help me, it would have been nice. But it's a lot. It was a lot. And I couldn't, I recognized that I couldn't do it on my own. And even with my dad in assisted living, I was going 7 days a week, taking care of things with my dad, helping my dad do things, shaving, helping my dad get dressed, all these things. And it took a toll on me as well. And it wasn't until this year that I sat down on the couch and was like, looked around and started realizing that my life was totally on hold. Mm-hmm. My whole house mm-hmm. was on hold. You know, everything mm-hmm. was on hold. And so, you know, my dad's in palliative care now, and the palliative care team offers therapy for caregivers and family members. And I took advantage of it. And it was huge because the therapist said to me, "Why do you go 7 days a week?" And I said, "Because I need to go." "Well, does your dad need you to go 7 days a week?" And I said, "Probably not. Does he even know that you're there 7 days a week?" "No, he doesn't." Why do you need to have him shaved?" And I said, "Well, I've never seen my dad grow a beard. You know, all my life, my dad's never grown a beard." So she's saying to me, you know, these are your things and you need to let go of these things. And it was huge for me. It was really huge. And so I was able to kind of step back, and now I go 5 days a week, maybe four. Sometimes it just depends. But it took a while because I would call on the days that I didn't go in, you know. And then she was like, "That's defeating the purpose. You're supposed to find things to do for yourself," you know. So,
well, after so many years of being dedicated to one goal, one thing, your father being okay, that must be really difficult to let go of.
It is. It's very difficult.
Gail, is this something, you know, Morgan's experience? I know the Rosalind Carter Institute does a lot of research and gets a lot of research and shares it with caregivers. Does this sound familiar to you, what Morgan's gone through?
Not only from my work with RCI, but also as a caregiver for my mother. Yeah. They do become the number, you just have the shining light on them, and that's all you think about. And that's to the detriment of your entire life. And let me say kudos to her therapist, because caregivers, we do need to rethink our priorities. So many times the caregiver will come in and say, "Oh, I can't get her to take a bath every day," and it comes a big wrestling match. And I say, "So let her sponge bath, or let it go a day. It's not the end of the world." And I'm so glad that she had a therapist to help her rethink that. I see so many times people put their loved one in a facility for safety reasons, and then they feel guilty, or they're just so concerned. They spend all their time there, but they do have to let go and start easing back into their own lives.
That's Gail Alston. She is with the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving. And she and statisticians say there is an alarming gap between the number of people who will need care in the coming years and those who can actually provide it. Also with us is Morgan Rowe, a Decatur resident, and we've been hearing about her experience taking care of her father, who has dementia. So, Gail, you mentioned there are few professional caregivers picking up this work. It's hard work, physically
it's hard
and emotionally,
work.
Requires training, doesn't pay much. So are there any incentives for people who could make more money in another field to grow the number of people who could care for people who are aging and have these kind of age-related diseases?
Well, that's going to be up to us to create that environment. Certainly, you know, there are direct care workers that are, you know, they are angels walking this earth, and they have a heart for it. And that's the only reason they do this work. It's not for the pay. They are overworked, underpaid, and underappreciated. So we as a society need to look at what are we going to do to build this up, this position up, so that it gets the honor that it deserves. And we can do that first by better wages and benefits, of course, but also by creating easier career ladders for them to be able to move up in the fields, because they need that opportunity. So many I've heard tell me they wanted that opportunity. But more important, they need to be getting more training, because when it comes to dementia care specifically, our direct care workers are not getting, they're getting maybe around 6 hours of dementia education as their certification. And that's woefully inadequate, because caring for someone living with dementia takes some very specific knowledge and skills so that you can make it the life of the person with dementia. You can improve their quality of life, and you can also make the family caregiver and the working caregiver job easier if they know how to respond to those difficult behaviors and how to make the experience easier for everybody concerned. Well, that takes training and education.
When we're looking at costs, however, this is not something Medicare does not pay for any in-home care. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So only if one is in a facility, and especially memory care facilities, those can be $10,000 more than that a month. Right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's astronomical.
So
yeah.
Is this something that, you know, beyond the training and beyond the career track, is there a policy question here about helping people to take care of people inside of their homes, perhaps getting some help coming in?
Well, I would think so. I think people have looked at things like tax credits. I was just reading about employers. Employers don't realize that this is an issue in their workforce, but they could be doing things to make it easier for caregivers to have the time off they need, maybe work part-time, have some additional training and education at their business. Harvard Business School did a survey of 1,500 employees. They found that 3 out of 4 people were providing care, and a third of those people had to quit their jobs to provide care. We need to find a way to combine someone's work life with their caregiving so that they'll ease up. Because when you have to quit your job, you not only lose that salary, you're losing retirement benefits as well. Mm-hmm. That will affect them for the rest of their lives. So really, all aspects of society needs to be looking at caregiving as an integral part of what needs to be addressed.
Morgan, was that true for you? How did you manage this with your work?
Well, I wasn't working at the time, really. I mean, I've been kind of through the military disabled from my knees. But so it kind of, the timing just kind of worked out just fine for me. But she's right. I mean, I couldn't imagine trying to do a full-time job and trying to do this with my father, traveling, you know, all those miles every other weekend to North Carolina to take care of things. It would have been impossible. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have that much time off to be able to do things like that.
I'm seeing here that Medicare Part A does, or Medicare Part B, do provide some eligible home health service care in the home. But it looks like it is a limited amount.
And the cost is crazy. Cost is crazy.
Yeah, that's what I've experienced in my own family. I will tell you that much. I'm wondering for you, Gail, you mentioned your mom. How did your experience caring for your mother inform both the work that you do with the Rosalind Carter Institute and your own plans for aging?
Well, certainly my experience with my mother has led me to take on the dementia education as a mission in life. I want caregivers who are caring for someone with dementia to know the things that I didn't know, and to have the skills that I didn't necessarily have at that time, because, you know, this is a growing field and we're learning as we go. But so that's how it affected me. I wish I could say that working at RCI made me a better caregiver, but unfortunately, just like most caregivers, nobody could tell me anything. I put all my time and effort into taking care of my mother. I did not take as much care of myself as I should have, and even now I'm suffering those consequences. So please do as I say, not as I did. Self-care is so important. important. It's not optional. And some we say that because it's like telling a man crawl across the desert, all you need is a glass of water. But caregivers with some education and some tools can find those little bits of time that they can use to take care of themselves and try to manage that stress, because it's the stress that will bring them down eventually.
Morgan, we're just about to wrap, but any thoughts for you on your own plans for aging?
Well, and that's a good question. I mean, this is something that I talk about with my friends is, have you got a plan? You need to get a plan. You need an exit plan, not just for your parents, but you need a plan for you. You know, the 36-hour day was really good for me. It was a great book to read.
All right. So that's one suggestion from Morgan Rowe, a longtime caregiver for her father. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Gail Alston of the Rosalind Carter Institute of Caregiving. She's with the Training Center for Excellence. You can find out more about it at our website, gpbnews.org. And coming up, if you send a twin brother into space, will he come back still identical? Stay with us for that. This is On Second Thought. We're back with On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. If an identical twin brother spends a year in space, will he return to Earth different than his sibling? The answer is yes. That's a result of NASA's twin study, which is out this month in Science magazine. In 2015, NASA sent astronaut Scott Kelly to the International Space Station. His brother Mark stayed home. Researchers found that being in space altered biomarkers in Scott's bodies. They're called telomeres. They typically shorten over time, which puts a person at higher risk for age-related health problems. But Scott's telomeres lengthened while he was at the space station. Space travel also seems to have changed how some genes work in Scott's body. GPB's Bill Nygut spoke with Scott after his return, and Scott opened the conversation with a little of his backstory.
You know, I think the story of my life, in a lot of respect, is a story of kind of sticking with it and endurance, always opportunities to fail along the way. You know, I flew in space twice, and then I had prostate cancer and had surgery and flew twice after that for 500 days in space.
So you were diagnosed before the 159-day mission, which you really wanted to go on.
Well, that was my career. I was an astronaut, and I wanted to fly in space again. And, you know, a long-duration flight, which has actually more stringent medical requirements. But I think it's, you know, it kind of shows people that have cancer that you can, with right treatment, maybe, you know, some luck, whatever, but you can continue your life and still, you know, have a future. And I think that's an important message.
Yeah, and you had a very tough decision to make, how to treat it.
Yeah.
And finally opted for surgery.
Yeah.
And got back into space, not once, but twice after that.
Yeah, I flew in space for 20 days, then I had cancer, and then I flew in space for 500 days.
Your brother Mark, you called him up when you were diagnosed, and since you're identical twins, you said, Mark, you better get checked.
Yeah, and he had cancer too, right?
But he had it on the opposite side of his prostate from you, just like you
have a little red dot on our foreheads.
Wow.
Mirror image twins, I guess.
Okay, so let's talk about that year-long mission. You started in Kazakhstan at the Russian Space Center at Baikonur. As you were marching out to the launch vehicle, you heard this. Земля в иллюминаторе, земля в иллюминаторе, земля в иллюминаторе видна. Как сын грустит о матери, как сын грустит о матери, грустим мы о земле, она одна. Как часы затмения, и как часы затмения, ждем света и земные, и видим сны. It's a Russian song?
Yes.
And they play it traditionally for their cosmonauts and for you as an astronaut going out to the launch pad, yes?
Yeah, every time you exit the cosmonaut hotel on the way to get suited up and then later to go to the launch pad, that's the song that plays, which is about an astronaut looking back at Earth and missing his home.
You quote some of the lyrics, and we don't dream of the cosmodrome's roar nor of this icy dark blue. Instead, we dream of the grass near our homes, the green, green grass. And in fact, when you come back, that's one of the things that you realize you've missed so much is nature, the grass, flowers, right?
Yeah, a lot of things like that that, you know, we don't have in space that we have on Earth. You know, interestingly enough, one of the cosmonauts, the guy I flew in space with, Gennady Padalka, he says, When we're in space, we miss Earth, and when we're on Earth, we miss space.
On that day, you began the mission. So you go out to the launch pad, and here's what happens next.
Crew reporting they're ready to go. The vehicle on internal power.
Auto sequence initiated.
Less than 15 seconds, the engine's igniting. Ramping up. And liftoff. Soyuz craft now passing a speed of over 4,700 miles an hour. Getting a look now at NASA astronaut Scott Kelly there in the right seat, giving a big thumbs up.
You have launched like that on any number of occasions. You describe what it's like to sit on top of some 280 tons of explosive propellant that launches you into space. Help us understand what that feels like.
Yeah, it gets your attention. You know, you're sitting on top of a bomb with liquid oxygen. In the case of the Russian Soyuz, liquid kerosene is the fuel. Yeah, there's very few things in life that are as serious as that.
You spent 520 days in space and traveled over 200 million miles, and yet you don't hold the record.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of my colleagues passed me up for total days in space. I still have the longest single flight of an American. But, you know, records are made to be broken, and that's, you know, hopefully someday people will be spending much more time in space than we have.
Your attitude was, I will not turn down any mission that's presented to me. And when they told you they wanted you to do 340 days in space, it had to have been a daunting idea for you, even though you were willing to accept it.
I had just recently gotten back from space when they started talking about a year-long flight. So, you know, the 6 months is a long time. I wasn't too interested because, you know, it's hard. But then as I got further away from it, I thought, you know, I want to fly in space again. I want it to be different. And if I flew another six-month flight, it might not be that different. And a year would make it twice as challenging or more. And I was right. So eventually I came around to the idea.
Got up there, and I think as you entered the space station, your thought was, this is crazy. Why am I doing this?
Yeah. You know, I'd been there previously, 4 years previously, and you get on board, and you're like, ooh, this is looking the same, sounding the same, smelling the same, and I'm day one of a year in space.
Your kids aren't with you. You have two children, but you're away from them on Christmas 3 years in a row. You had gone through a difficult divorce and had to deal with the fallout from that.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing about being in space for a long period of time. It's not your personal safety, but you always worry about the safety of your family and your loved ones on Earth, because if something happens to them, you're not coming home. And I experienced that firsthand on the flight before that, when my sister-in-law, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, was shot in Tucson, Arizona.
You were watching CNN, which you did frequently, and suddenly the feed was cut off.
Well, I didn't notice it was cut off. Oh. I was actually fixing the toilet at the time, but the ground control center in Houston, yeah, they did cut it off because they didn't want me to learn that news from the television.
And you were told there was a private message that, of course, would not be part of the publicly monitored communications mm-hmm. between ground control and the shuttle and the space station. What happened?
So I was working on the toilet. It was a Saturday, January 8th, 2011. And I got a call from the control center, and they called me to the radio, basically, and said they were going to privatize the space-to-ground channel. The chief of the astronaut office needed to talk to me. She came on about 5 minutes later and said, I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just going to tell you. Your sister-in-law, Gabby, was shot. A bunch of other people also reported that some people had been killed. And that was kind of it with the phone call. You know, hey, we'll do whatever we can to support you. I said, you know, let me know whatever news you get, even if it's not confirmed. So whatever the news was reporting. I quickly got on the phone with my brother and my family, Amico. Later, Houston said, as I asked them I asked them to tell me everything. They said, you know, I think the Associated Press was reporting that Gabby had died, and she had not. got on the phone with a good friend of mine, Tillman Fertitta, in Houston, Texas, because I couldn't get my brother on the phone then because he was already in the air on the way to Tucson. He was in Houston. And Tillman, my good friend, he explained that, or he said to me, he says, you know, I don't know how I know this, but I just know, you know, Gabby's not dead. Doesn't make sense. You know, she would still be in the operating room. You know, she's still in the operating room, so she's not, hasn't died. And he was right.
Your brother, Mark, and your sister-in-law, we all know, have gone on to be really fearless advocates for better gun safety laws. I may be missing something, but have you joined in that effort, or do you leave that to them? Do you participate in any of those activities yourself?
Not in any kind of formal way. I mean, that's their issue. That's you know, their cause. You know, I have my own opinions. You know, one of which is clearly we need to do something, right? Because what we're doing doesn't really work. So something should be done. Otherwise, people are going to still be killed in this country with guns on a regular basis. So I'm just shocked that our government basically has chosen to just absolutely ignore this issue and do nothing about it.
Yeah, she's made a remarkable comeback, but clearly your family still has to deal with the aftermath of that. She is still has issues that are probably going to be with her for the rest of her life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What's that like for you?
Yeah, so she's got some, you know, significant disabilities as a result of the shooting. And it's something that, you know, she and her family is going to have to live with for the rest of her life. You know, in some ways, you know, because she was a public person, she has meaningful work to do to help in this area. So that's a positive thing that she has that to occupy her time and to do something very important. But, yeah, like you said, it's something that, you know, her especially has to live with for the rest of her life.
You dealt with another really difficult tragedy on February 1st, 2003, when the space shuttle Columbia, this was, I think, a Saturday, as I recall, and you were on Earth. You were basically home. And of course, we all know, let's listen to what happened.
A considerable emergency going on right now throughout the space community, throughout NASA and Mission Control, one can only imagine.
NASA says none of the seat restraints, helmets, and spacesuits used by the doomed crew of the space shuttle Columbia worked well as the ship disintegrated during
reentry.
The rest of
us suffered a huge loss. Seven shuttle astronauts on board, including the first ever Israeli.
You had several friends who were flying the Columbia that day, but one in particular, I think, Laurel Clark.
So three of my classmates were on Columbia. Four other of my colleagues that, you know, like you said, it was a national tragedy. You know, really unfortunate.
Her son and your daughter Samantha, they played together.
Yeah, they were close at the time, Laurel used to pick Samantha up and take her and Ian to the zoo and on the weekends, and we would spend, you know, my family and her family would spend time together.
So when that happens, when Samantha learns of the death of a mom who used to take her to play with her son, how do you talk to your children about that?
You know, you explain to them as best you can what happened, and you tell them, you know, Laurel was, and the rest of the crew members were doing something they felt was very important. They knew it was risky, although, you know, no one goes into this thinking that they're going to get killed. They think they might, and they hope they don't. But, you know, and that, you know, she would, Laurel, and I think the other crew members would want to see things because of the, you know, the benefits of doing that.
What probably made it harder was that you ended up being part of the crew that went out to look for pieces of the Columbia wreckage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite an odd thing that space shuttle broke apart over Texas. And, you know, the people that worked closest with the crew members, fellow astronauts, engineers, instructors, were only a two-hour drive from the crash site.
Yeah. On a lighter note, what the heck were you doing putting on a gorilla suit on the International Space Station.
Why not a gorilla suit?
Your brother Mark loved this idea, right?
Well, it was his idea. He says, I'm sending you a gorilla suit. I said, what? Why a gorilla suit? And actually, it got a lot of attention, some negative from a lot of the, you know, some folks that, you know, like to criticize NASA. You know, why would NASA spend all this money to fly a gorilla suit? Well, you know, NASA spends money to fly foam and packing material and sometimes lead ballast. So it really doesn't cost anything to fly a gorilla suit. And when I thought about it, I, you know, thought about how sometimes I'll go to a school and try to talk to kids, and there's always this kid like me that was in the back of the room not paying attention. Well, a gorilla in space, you cannot not pay attention to that.
All right. The final day came, and you departed the space station to come back. You talk about the reentry, coming back in, you came back in a Russian capsule, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you described trying to prepare other colleagues of yours for what it was like to fly that Russian capsule, or not fly it, to sit in it as it dropped like a stone traveling at extraordinary speeds. What is that like?
It's crazy, actually, thinking about it. You know, you undock from the space station, you fire some engines to slow down by just a few hundred miles an hour, and then right after that, the three sections are exploded apart. Some of the pieces are actually hitting the window right by the side of your head. You can see stuff, debris flying outside. As you hit the atmosphere, you're in this 3,000-degree fireball. It gets hot inside. You have pieces of the heat shield flying by. It looks like, you know, just white, hot, burning material. Eventually, the window just burns to a crisp, and you can't see outside anymore. It's kind of like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel, but while you're on fire. But as soon as you realize you're not going to die, the most fun you've ever had in your life. You know, if I hated being in space for a year, I'd do it all over again just for that last 20 minutes.
Well, you know, you say the same thing about your spacewalks, that it's you, when you think about them, it's after they're over that they're really fun.
Yeah, it's type 2 kind of fun. Type 1 fun is the roller coaster. You know, it's fun while you're doing it. Type 2 fun is the things that are fun when you're done. And, it's definitely that.
Scott Kelly, as we end our conversation, you've been retired from the program now for a while. Do you want to go back? Do you miss going into space?
Every day.
Scott Kelly, I really appreciate your spending so much time with us. Thanks a lot for being here.
No, my pleasure.
GPB's Bill Nye get there speaking with astronaut Scott Kelly, one of the twins in a NASA study. The results of the study are in this month's issue of Science magazine. That's all we have time for today. On Second Thought is produced by Leighton Rowell, the Raven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Jesse Neiswanger is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, Amy Kiley is senior producer, and Sarah Shariari is managing editor of GPB News. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, thanks for listening. And this is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting.